Alaskans, wherever you are, welcome to the Must Read Alaska Show, coming to you from somewhere in Alaska. This is the place where we talk about, you guessed it, Alaska, where we keep the mainstream media on their toes, and where we are standing up for what's right in a world run by leftists. You can find out more by heading over to mustreadalaska.com, and also checking out the Must Read Alaska YouTube channel for some really great content. But first, let's get this party started.
Welcome, everybody, to the Must Read Alaska Show. I'm your host, John Quick, coming to you live from somewhere in Alaska. I hope everybody's having a phenomenal day, and I bet folks are wishing for more sun. Man, it just doesn't seem to stop snowing. Yesterday, it was snowing here on the Kenai Peninsula. I think Anchorage has had, I think last time I saw, 130 inches of snow, so hopefully sun is right around the river bend. I want to thank everybody that listens, watches, and reads Must Read Alaska. If you want to help keep the lights on, just go to mustreadalaska.com. On the little right-hand side there, there's a button. Click on that. Every $5, $10, $100 helps keep the lights on here at Must Read Alaska. If you want to sponsor the Must Read Alaska show, just email me, John, J-O-H-N, at mustreadalaska.com, and you can sponsor the show. But without further ado, I have a special guest today, Senator Mike Schauer. Welcome back to the Must Read Alaska show. You've been on several times, and folks really love you.
Well, happy to be back. Lots going on, as usual.
Yeah, really excited you're here. We're going to kind of cover a bunch of different topics. But first, just want to get your take. How's session going? This session, we haven't caught up yet. This session, I think last time we chatted was right before session. So how's it going this session? Give folks a kind of brief 30,000-foot view on how it's been.
Well, we will run ourselves out of money in a few short years because we're going back to the ATM, also known as the Permanent Fund Dividend, which we've been doing for years, but that's getting tight. There's not too many years left, especially if we pass more of these bills like defined benefits and higher spending and various departments, education, et cetera, internet, you know, for everybody, et cetera. So the money tree is running out a little bit. That's one. It's kind of funny, Jonathan, because I'm actually having a pretty good session in the sense of I think some folks think they got me by keeping myself, kicking me into a minority, like, oh, we got that guy. Like, this has been the most relaxing session for me ever in 7 years here. I'm like, I'm getting lots of sleep. I'm working out every day. I'm not responsible for any of the insanity coming out of the Senate. That's the 8 Republicans that joined with 9 left-wing Democrats and gave them power. So I don't have to worry about that. I can vote no and just be fine. So it's actually far from being like a gotcha to like, this is like recharging my batteries. It's been great. So I'm like, and they don't know Sun Tzu at all, right? Keep your friends close and enemies closer. If I was dangerous or a problem, last thing you do is turn us loose, right? And give us nothing but time to dig. And anyway, so there's that from my perspective. But there's been a lot of topics, which, you know, this year that's come up, you know, defined benefits, which, like I said, we were talking earlier, hopefully is dead. Because we really, if we're going to do this right, then the younger generation wants defined contribution. They want those 401ks they can take with them. Cash is king. They don't want to be stuck in a defined benefit plan in Alaska for years and years if they decide it doesn't work. So that's one thing. Hopefully that's died and we can improve on the defined contribution plan to make it something that is attractive. You have the internet funding one that turned into a massive omnibus bill for education that got also involved in the governor's vetoes on it. We had his executive orders and the override vetoes for that. And of course the budgetary stuff, right? So there's actually quite a bit going on as you expect. And we're the end, coming from the end of the 2 year session. There's also a lot of people that are going to kick and scream and try to twist arms to get their personal bills through, because if they die here in 4 or 5 weeks, then they're dead for, they got to start over again, right? Because it'd be the next 2 year session. So there's some of that as well. The first year, the bills can slide into the second year, so they don't panic too much. But now people are going to be desperate to get some of that across, which means horse trading. I'll vote for yours if you vote for mine, even though we're not supposed to do that. That certainly happens. And, you know, people's promised their votes in the Senate. There's a binding caucus. So people have promised their votes already to leadership. They're going to get their vote. And so it's just lots of that going on. Some of it's politics as usual and standard, but those are the big things. We can get into details, but that's kind of the initial, you know, F-22, 60,000 foot view instead of 30,000 nice. View on the F-15 back in the day. I'm going to go there.
Well, let's talk about the education bill. Cause I think a lot of folks heard from, you know, the Democrat side that conservatives don't care about kids, and, you know, how dare the conservatives not vote for this bill, or, you know, the governor vetoed the bill and all those kinds of things. Talk to me about your perspective on the educational bill and kind of the, you know, morph from an internet bill to an educational bill to the governor vetoing it to them trying to override the veto. Give us your perspective on how that process was and what you, where do you think it's going?
So a couple, there's three paths here. We'll try to cover them all. The original SB 140 and what came out as a quick, clean House bill after that whole fiasco and the override, which failed. And I was one of the ones that upheld the governor's veto. Look, here's the bottom line for us. Those of us, at least in my particular case, maybe some different nuances. The education omnibus bill, as it came to be from just being a pure internet bill for remote Alaska, got Christmas tree with a whole bunch of stuff. $175 million for a $680 BSA increase. Said some charter school stuff the governor and some of us wanted. Had some accountability measures. Had some correspondence. Had teacher recruitment and retainment bonuses in there, et cetera. And almost all that got stripped out. Some of those people basically stood up on the floor and lied during the debate to override the vetoes. Oh, it has this, that, and the other. It's a compromise. No, it wasn't. Almost everything the governor wanted was stripped out. Anything that the conservatives wanted regarding accountability and more school choice was taken out. But what they got was their BSA increase and a bunch of, and some other stuff. And so that's all they cared about was the money. And as I stood up on the floor and debated and told people, I said, I'm not against education spending, obviously. I would argue those that say you don't care about the children, but no, you don't care about the children because you're going to saddle them with debt. They're going to have to solve this problem. I think the ones that say that, oh, if we're not spending more money, you don't care about the children. I'm going to flip that on its head. Because they don't care, because our kids and grandkids are going to deal with the mess we've created today. So that's point number one. But as I pointed on the floor and turned around and look at teachers, and I've been telling teachers, I hope they hear this loud and clear, is when we are going to spend more money, I want to know where it's going. That is good common sense governance. That has nothing to do with not wanting to help the teachers and the kids who are precisely who I want to help and make sure what more money we spend goes to them. I asked the question on the floor, Jonathan. I looked around when I said, is there anybody in here that can tell me where this money's going to go and guarantee it goes to teacher? And everybody was looking down, looking away. They refused to look me in the eye. Why? Because they know that $175 million is going to go dump right into the same school system that over the one-third increase to education spending in the last 20 years, almost none of it has gone to the teachers in the form of pay increases, et cetera, et cetera. So don't tell me that we're going to increase money with no accountability when I can't guarantee that money's going to go to the teachers. And then, by the way, we're going to have no required metrics coming back, knowing that we're spending tops in the nation for K through 12 education, but we're at the bottom for performance. So I want to see the bang for the buck. Those are simple common sense things we asked for, Jonathan, to include some more correspondence or homeschooling choices and options for parents to give them more. Some more charter school stuff so that parents had options for their kids. Because if it's really for the children, you want kids to have more and better options, right? Well, they stripped that away. And then really the one big thing Dunleavy asked for, and they played chicken and he called their bluff, was that he wanted those bonuses for teachers so that we could guarantee, which I was a fan of. That's telling me, oh, that money goes directly to the teachers. That's the frontline troops, right? That's the law enforcement, the first responders, the soldiers, sailors, airmen and marine. Those are the ones on the front line. That's the teachers. And that goes directly to them to help recruit them and retain them. Well, I'm good with that. Well, guess what? They stripped it out. And the governor goes, you strip out what I want. You're not giving what you want. I'm vetoing the whole thing. That, in essence, is the battle that came to play. Now, the AFT, NEA, and the others, the other big union, the thugs out there, were going, you guys hate the children. No, we don't. All we asked for is the things we just said to include what the governor asked for, Jonathan, and they stripped it all out. And so that was where my no vote came from. Against that, and to uphold the governor's veto. So unless we can do better with what we're spending, I'm not just going to throw more money at the problem. You might as well throw it right out the window because there's no guarantee. What's the point? So that was the big part of that battle, and where the conservatives and the Republicans that stuck together to uphold the governor's veto. That's why we did it. Not because we're against education, not because we understand we're going to have to spend more money. We wanted to see how it's going to target it. Last point, and I'll let you counter here or have some other question about this, because I want to see, I know I'm on a roll, right? Here you go. You let Dozer go. Because I want to see targeted spending. Why in the world are we trying to pound a square peg in a round hole? This is no different than DOE in Washington, D.C., telling us what the federal strings are attached, and Alaska is a very unique place, right? So how come we're forcing a 680 BSA down everybody's throats? Maybe rural Alaska that has real need for $800 or $900 BSA, which, by the way, has the least number of students, so we wouldn't be spending that much money, but they really need it. Logistics are expensive, food, fuel, et cetera. Teachers trying to get them to stay out there, giving them bonuses. But maybe the Matsu said, hey, we're good. We've done good with our money. We don't need it right now. Anchorage said they could live on $100 for the next year or two. for they need more. Kenai said they didn't need quite as much. So, and by the way, that's where most of our students are, right? Fairbanks to Homer in the road system. We could have lower BSAs for those, and it would cost us less because there's most of the students are there, and we could target individual districts that really need it, but spend less money and get more bang for a buck. Why aren't we doing that? Wouldn't that be good governance with our money to target it to individual districts? But we don't do that. 100%. Everybody needs the money. No, they don't. They said they didn't need it. So we don't do, again, not good governance as elected officials, not spending the taxpayer money wisely. So I'm against it until I see some of that. There you go.
What do you think the do you think there's a chance that a new bill will be brought forward and talked about, or we run out of time for the session?
Well, we'll see if it how it ends up, right? Because yes, there is something coming through the House that's got education stuff in it again. But again, you've seen how this battle goes. It could get Christmas tree. They could add all kinds of weird stuff. Who knows? Maybe it's something to make it. Maybe it won't. As I said on the floor, we knew we were going to add one time again funding. So the exact amount of that BSA increase is in the budget this year, $175 million, 680 BSA is in one time. Yes, I know it's better to do long term if we could have the appropriate increase, like we said, targeted, et cetera, those other things. So there was stability, but they're not going to, they don't care about stability, Jonathan. They just want the money. I'm talking the administration, the unions and others just want the money. They don't care about accountability. They don't want accountability. So maybe something will pass. I hope it does. But we'll see. It's politics. And then, to be clear, the internet bill came back in the House bill very cleanly. I was the only senator to vote against that because it's basically anti-free market, anti-competition, because it's basically directing that just we're going to lay fiber optic cable. It takes out low Earth orbit satellites and other things that we could do right now. And it was $40 million a year from Alaskan, from our actual government spending. And then, you know, people say, well, you know, it's we're going to get $360 million of federal grants for that. So we're $400 million a year on this. But that's free money. That doesn't cost us anything. I'm like, it doesn't. We don't pay taxes.
It always costs you something.
I love this idea here that we get free money from the federal government as if we don't pay taxes. And income tax, as if we don't pay property tax, as if we don't pay sales tax, as if we don't pay any taxes already. And every time you buy a gallon of gasoline, you're paying a tax. I mean, we play, so it's like another almost $500 million, and it's going to go to certain people. It's going to go to certain companies. It's limiting competition. I did the math and tried to put this out, Jonathan, for the 40 million without the $360 million of free money, that 40 million could buy 67,000 subscriptions. Of the system of Starlink and buy 444,000 $90 high speed internet services for so you could fill every house in Alaska and every person
every adult gets one
tomorrow for less money than what we're going to spend billions on to lay fiber optic cable all over the state and tearing up the tundra and the environment and everything else to do it. Holy mackerel. So again, I was a no vote on that one because it's not. If it was open to all and we looked for the best, cheapest option, I could be okay with that, but that's not what we're doing. We're going to spend tons of money for something that's getting to be old and is going to require tearing up the, you know, all kinds of, you know, tundra, other stuff to lay the cable. It's going to take years to do it. And we're not giving it, you know, right. You got in Alaska right now in the bush, you're going to see freaking Starlink dishes all over the place. I've got it at home. Works like a champ. Instead of 180 bucks for cable I was paying, now I'm paying 90 bucks a month and it's high-speed internet. Well, it took me 10 minutes to hook it up. It was nothing. Anyways, so there's the big battle we had on the omnibus bill that clean one went through, although I voted against it and I said why. And there is another bill moving through the House. We'll see what happens with that one. So that's kind of the whole education battle in a nutshell.
Nice. Well, I think for this year, the governor put a full permanent fund in his budget that he presented. What do you think the chances of folks getting a full permanent fund this cycle is going to be? We got slim to none, or we got a 50-50 chance? What's your take on it?
0.0 grade point average, Blutowski. You're not going to get anything from that. I would predict the House using different funding sources has like a $2,200. So we'll see when they're done with the budget here this week. My guess is the Senate's going to want something like a $1,300 one because they've got lots of places they got to spend money on the government. So remember, Jonathan, here, the private sector is never mentioned. We don't talk about the private sector. We don't care about the private sector because that money would go to the private citizens and the private sector, right? We want to spend it all on government. We will take every penny until every penny is gone on government and government constituencies. That's constituencies. That's big unions. That's public sector unions. Don't care about private sector so much, although they get involved in this fight at the high level. They tend to be very left, very Democrat, you know, oriented, big government types. So the bottom line is that your dividend is going to be somewhere between $1,300, $1,600, $1,700 at best, would be my guess. And the reality is, and this goes back to laying the foundation, Jonathan, for the last 7, 8, 10 years plus, this government has grown in size that we have to keep taking from what I call now the ATM. You go to the bank, put your ATM card, that ATM is actually called the PFD. We're taking money from the permanent fund dividend, the money that was set aside for that. We've been taking more and more of it every year. And here in a few years, 4, 5, 6 years down the road at best, we're going to run out of money because we're spending it on all these different programs. And that's before we pass the defined benefits, another 100 million or whatever that's going to cost us. That's before another education increase. That's before the internet bill. That's before all these things. We got about $125 million a year of just contract increases. We're already locked in the books. So every 5 years, it's another $500 million plus of spending. We're already well under $1 billion left of all revenue sources coming into the state government before we pay a PFD. So we're under $1 billion left to play with. And $1 billion is like a $1,600, $1,700 PFD for every eligible Alaskan. That's all that's left. And we're already below that. And we're spending another X amount, hundreds of millions every year. See where it's going? This is the math. People don't understand that. The PFD is about to become a dinosaur, extinct, here in a few short years. People say they support it. They don't. There's three Democrats that have always said they support it when they were in the minority. Well, they voted against the PFD every year for 2 years running now, or a couple of years running. So all the support, almost all of the support for the PFD has evaporated in this building. There's even a lot of Republicans, even some that are more like left of center Republicans that are like, yeah, PFD, it's more important that we spend it on government. So I don't want to be pessimistic about it, but just the math alone pushes you in a direction, Jonathan. There's not going to be anything left without a couple things, right? To pay us, and I hate it because the narrative was false. It's been a lie all along, but they've set us up. So this is now the reality of the math. If we paid a statutory PFD, the only way we're going to do it is to draw money from savings, which long-term isn't a smart move, right? Or tax, right? Institute a sales tax and income tax or something to be able to then pay the dividend, or chop spending. What do you think the options are right now of chopping spending in this legislature? Zero again.
not going to happen.
So you're left to two options then. You're going to draw your savings down. They're going to be loath to do that because that's less money for government to spend, right? So that's not really an option. And, you know, there's enough of us, including the governor, that aren't a fan of any taxes to keep funding the party here with the big government. So where are we left? We're left with balancing the budget every year. Well, the only way you're going to do that is PFD gets smaller and smaller as they go back to that ATM and pull the lever until that's out. So it's the end is near on this because we're going to hit the wall before too long. And people go, well, what about the Willow project that Biden nearly shut down and we got a little bit come? Remember, most of that is going to be tax write-offs and other stuff. We're not going to get a lot of money from that extra couple hundred thousand barrels for a while. I think I heard projections like 2032, maybe before we start seeing anything from that we're going to hit the wall long before then. And all of this being said, Jonathan, is before the assumptions that the oil price stays at a certain level, that the stock market continues to perform, right? And we don't have another hit to tourism like we had in COVID where we lost all three. If any of those factors fall out, we are instantly at that wall already because there's that much less money to spend. We have set ourselves up to fail. We have set our children up to fail. And the old guard and long-term legislators are part of that problem that have done that to us and put us here in this place, Jonathan. We have solutions. We have the ability to solve it now before it's too late. And they refuse to move. The whole body refuses to move on solving things like a comprehensive fiscal policy that we have in place that could go tomorrow. They won't do it. So the people to be blamed are sitting inside that building right now, Jonathan, and they will not solve the problem before it's too late. And most of them will be gone. When the problem really comes up, they'll pray, oh, I'm out of here. They'll be gone. And they'll leave that in somebody else's lap, which is very frustrating for me because we could solve it and we should.
Yeah, I think one of the things that is frustrating for just normal everyday folks that I hear from, at least that's all I can speak to, is, you know, you'll get people in the House or even assembly member people or city council people or state senators run on, you know, cutting the budget or fiscal restraints, and then they get elected and there's never any cutting that takes place. Why do you think that happens? Is it a number of different factors? Is it because people go to Juneau and they can't really, you know, their person that elected them can't drive down to the Capitol and keep them accountable? You know, just there just doesn't seem to be much cutting ever happening. What's your take on that?
It's definitely multiple things. You could talk about some of it. I mean, what happened when the governor had some cuts to spending back in 2019? Oh, even the Republicans, most of the Republicans lost their minds on that one. We barely held on to any of those, and they pretty much reversed them all with overrides the very next January after the cuts in 2019. So you have people. I heard one long-term legislator tell me years ago, like, well, Mike, if you don't have a constituency if you don't spend government money, meaning unions and others that aren't going to vote for you if you don't spend money for them, right? So it's a combination of things. You have, in my opinion, a very weak Republican Party that doesn't hold Republicans accountable to the principle and the platform of smaller government, controlling spending, et cetera. And Republicans come down here and join with Democrats and throw power to Democrats, and the Republican Party says and does nothing. And I hear them complain, oh, we can't get much donations. Nobody wants to give money to the Republican Party. I'm like, you think? Because you don't do anything. You let Republicans campaign as Republicans and take your money and get elected and then go down to Juneau and give power to Democrats and act like Democrats and spend more money. And the Republican Party is going to continue to shrink and lose power in Alaska because the Republican Party itself won't show any spine and stand up. We just need to get Republicans elected. What good is that if they come down here and do what they do and give power to Democrats repeatedly? So that is another reason why. But like I said, it's not one factor as to why they do that. And frankly, the old story of the frog and the scorpion, you know, across the river where the scorpion's like, hey, give me a ride. Trust me, I won't sting you. They get halfway across, stings the frog. They both drown. The frog goes, why did you sting me? It's like, well, I'm a scorpion. You're really going to blame the legislators doing for what they're doing and spending more money and passing bills and getting away with it when the people keep sending the same ones back? Whose fault is that? I can't blame the scorpion for being a scorpion, Jonathan. I meant to blame the people. If you keep sending back the same people, don't get mad that they're taking your dividend or increasing spending on government or going to cause taxes here soon to take more money out of your wallet or won't give you school choice or et cetera, et cetera. If you keep sending the same people back that are the ones joining with Democrats or executing those policies, that's on you. What else can I say? There's nothing else I can do. I'm one out of 60. I have very little power. Now I'm in a minority of three, right? Not because, and I got to keep saying this because this rumor keeps floating around, like Shelley Hughes, oh, you guys are working with the FBI. No, we weren't. We were interviewed because there was a bribery scandal going on, like many legislators were. I happen to know there was a legislator that was working with the FBI because I got tired of hearing about it. So I asked. That one's currently in the majority in the Senate, but it certainly wasn't Hughes and I. But if you can't kill the message, Jonathan, you do what? You kill the messenger. So the reason that Hughes, Myers, and I are not in the majority right now is because we all three refuse to join a binding caucus. We don't believe it is ethical or legal for us to promise our vote for 2 years because you're not ever supposed to promise your vote. So things like the binding caucus and the power structure is another reason why things are happening the way they are, because legislators come down here and go, well, I got to get a gavel. I got to get a chairmanship. I have to be in the majority or I can't make a difference. And so they basically sell a little bit of their soul to that binding caucus. That's another thing. So there's a bunch of reasons why, but they all collectively, and it's different, right? Every reason is not the same for every legislator, right? Why do some hate the dividend so much? Some because they don't want to ever be taxed. Some because they want to give it all to government. Some because they think it's a free giveaway and all of our money is going to go to the federal government via taxes, Amazon, and Alaska Airlines. I saw that right out of one of the legislator, current senator's newsletter. Oh, that money just goes out to Amazon and Alaska Airlines as if people being able to buy plane tickets to Hawaii in the wintertime to give their family some sun is a bad thing, right? Just the disdain for the PFD and the different reasons are many, but it's there and it's real. So long answer to your short question is there are a lot of reasons, but it's not, again, it goes back to the people. If they keep electing the same people, nothing's going to change. It won't. So
you posted something interesting recently, which I actually read a similar article about NPR. There's an article out, I don't know, I think it was this week, maybe last week, and somebody had done some research on the NPR kind of headquarters in DC and the 30 or so news editors at NPR, like the headquarter building. All of them were registered Democrats. There wasn't a single registered Republican in an editorial role. It's a government-funded media source. You had an interesting post recently about it. What's your thoughts on, you know, government-funded media that, you know, purports to be unbiased, but is clearly pretty biased?
If government, if media that is taking public taxpayer money is going to not be objective and is only going to tell one side of the story, they're only going to suppress conservative ideas and voices and policies and officials, and they're going to suppress bad stuff about the left and those policies and officials, et cetera, then they should be stripped of public money, period. There's no question to that, right? So you have to maintain balance if you're going to take public money, because that's what basically the law demands. So if NPR and PBS and others are taking public money and they're all Democrats, and we've shown, and some whistleblowers within those organizations have shown the bias, then the answer to me, the simple answer is they can still do what they do. They just have to do it on their own time. People have a right to spend their own money the way they want to, as far as I'm concerned, but you can't spend my taxpayer money on something that's going to come back and blast me because I'm on the right side of the spectrum and you give a Democrat a pass. No, absolutely not. So the right answer, Jonathan, is you just strip the money, period.
Yeah, it seems, you know, if the government's going to be shelling out big checks to media sources, then, you know, I'll go stand in line. I want to get a big old check for Must Read Alaska.
Wouldn't that be nice? Except you are on the right side of the political spectrum, so they're not going to give you the time of day, right?
Yeah.
And you know, this is the thing where they go, oh, well, you know, it's not really, they're not really biased. Yes, they are. There is not one thinking adult that is intellectually honest in this country that doesn't understand 100% that the U.S. media, by and large, leans left or way left. Everybody knows it. It's fake news. There's a reason fake news has gained traction with the citizenry, because they know it's true. The news is fake in the sense of they censor everything and they only push one narrative by and large. Yeah, Fox News is not even that really conservative anymore with the takeover with the Suns. But that's like, you know, somebody posted, well, that's a counterbalance to Fox News. I'm like, counterbalance? How can that be? There's one against 100. That's not a counterbalance. If it was 49-51, I could say counterbalance. It's not. It's over 90% plus of all major U.S. media is left or way left. That's a counterbalance would be there's only two, MSNBC and Fox News. Okay, that'd be a counterbalance. But it's also CBS, ABC, NBC, PBS, NPR. Everybody else leans left. We know it. The whistleblowers know it. You can see their content and understand it. So look, if you want to do that and it's publicly funded, go for it. But not, or privately funded, go for it. But if it is publicly funded money, you can't do that. That is not fair or balanced, and 90% of the country is not liberal or progressive or Marxist, communist, socialist, whatever the heck they are. It's not. I would argue probably still a majority of the country is at least centrist, if not slightly right of center on their overall views. When you look at polling data across the country, they are. You might see more on one issue. Maybe it's abortion or spending or, you know, Ukraine or something. You'll see some variances in there. But by and large, the country's pretty moderate in the sense of politically, not polarized far left or far right. But the country still leans a little more right as pro-America, pro-capitalism, et cetera, except who? Our college kids that are coming out of our indoctrination centers that are wildly left, that we all know through whistleblowers and other organizations that pointed that out, including the students. And my youngest son, I brought that up on a recent radio show. I said, you know, my youngest was talking about all of his friends that come from the heart of the Red Matsu, the Red Heart of Alaska, right? A lot of veterans, highest per capita in the nation, actually, in the Matsu. He said, oh, conservative, pro-America kids, you know, raised with families, conservative when they left and went to high school with them all. They went off to college for a year, came back, flaming liberals, flaming. Jonathan, don't sit here and try to give me a snow job that the college and university centers, by and large in this country, are not indoctrination centers for Marxism, communism, socialism, because they are. And you can see the proof is in the pudding when the kids come back after going there for 1 year. They've already twisted their young minds. And what 18, 19, 20-year-old has the gumption or the experience to go against a 50-year-old college professor that seems to know everything, that really has done nothing in his life, never lived under communism or Marxism, never been to Venezuela or Iran or North Korea or the old Soviet Union or communist China? I've been to some of those. I got news for you. It ain't real good. And there's a whole lot of people leaving there to try to get here where they have some freedom and protection. So, but now we're convincing an entire generation of our young folks that those things are great. And it's only because we got it wrong those other dozen times. This time, we'll get Marxism right and it's going to be a utopia. No, it's not. But that's for another podcast because we could spend too much time on that topic. So, anyways, sorry. I'm off on a rant. I've had 2 cups of coffee this morning, as you can tell.
Hey, you're ready to go, right?
Like I am. Yeah. So.
So, recently there was a disaster in Baltimore where the ship hit the bridge and it collapsed. I oftentimes think about how tragic it would be if something similar like that happened to Alaska. We get pretty much all of our food from the lower 48 barged up here. Talk to me about how you think how ready Alaska is for an actual disaster to happen. Seems like we're not super prepared for something like that if it happens.
We're not prepared at all. If we were to have a long-term earthquake shutdown, EMP event, the food and the fuel stop flowing, most Alaskans will die through a winter cycle. And that's not being pessimistic, that's being realistic. Last big exercise I did was an Arctic Edge in 2010. It was an earthquake simulation, like a big one that hit the, and that was, it took out the port and the airport for 6 to 8 weeks is the estimate for a big earthquake that would be south central like that. And that was with the entire United States being intact, trying to come up and help us. Imagine if regionally they weren't available to help because they were also suffering from an EMP or something else that would happen. Even not a foreign nation, just like a massive solar event could take out, like a Carrington event, right? Would wipe out so much stuff today. So we did that exercise, and there were estimates of tens of thousands of Alaskans dying because we couldn't get food or fuel. There is no airlift ability to bring it up like the Berlin airlift. It doesn't exist in the US. And by the way, where the heck would you put it? Because all the airports are down in South Central. Bridges are down. There's no ability to move it. There's no railroad because we've never built one into Canada that they could bring trains up and have them on the backside. You're not going to get it with trucks. Here's my point. The point of the exercise was showing if you're not prepared to survive for at least 6 to 8 weeks on your own, food, fuel, medicine, whatever you need to survive, then you're in big, big trouble because a big event like that, especially wintertime, because Murphy's Law, that's when it's going to happen, right? Is December, January, February. Then it's going to be very difficult for people to make it through. And the bigger population centers, the less prepared people are because they live day to day. The farther out you get to the smaller, more rural communities, the more people are prepared to survive longer because they're more self-sufficient. They store food, they don't come in as often. So they're used to being on a 1, 2, 3, 4 week cycle, right? And the bush is even more so because they get less supplies coming in, so they got to store. So the point of all that, it's a very good question when you look at something like that bridge when it collapsed, when the ship hit it, is that it should remind people that if you're not prepared for at least a few months to get through, the government cannot help you. The government does not have the resources to keep you alive. And to give an example, we went through some math and I was trying to explain to people just the Matsu, 110,000 people, and you consider, say, 10,000 of them were self-sufficient. You got 100,000 people. That's 300,000 meals a day, right? A day times 30. How many meals is that over a month that the government would have to supply people with? Because within 3 to 4 days, the shelves are empty. So the point is that kind of help doesn't exist. What little the military or the government structure has is going to be required just to try to keep them alive, right? So depending on the level of disaster and how long it takes for recovery, if you're not prepared for that, the government's not going to save you. And I'll give you a very small example, Jonathan. Back in a year and a half, 2 years ago, when we had the Christmas disaster with all the winds and the store collapsed up in Delta Junction, the grocery store. There were people that were out of food within a couple of days. And I was thinking, and I'm talking to the guard, trying to get them out to rescue people, help them, get them moving, doing what we can do to get supplies going that way. I'm like, that's rural Alaska, where you would think people be a little more prepared. And I was shocked how many people were not prepared when the grocery store roof collapsed and they shut the store down. I would be getting dozens and dozens of calls of people needing help. I'm like, now, can you imagine that in New York City or Portland, Seattle, any other big city where there are millions of people and all of a sudden the supplies stop coming in? Just like, don't be there. Not a good place to be in that scenario. So be prepared, folks. My point, best you can be. Not everybody has a lot of resources, but I got my mom doing this in Florida. Jonathan said, every time you go to the store, just buy an extra can or two of something. Just something small. Over the course of months or a year, you'll actually build up a nice little stock of stuff that will last you for a while. And then what else does that do? That takes pressure off the system. Every person or family that is a little more prepared is less the system's going to be stressed from emergency services and the military and the guard and everybody else trying to make it work, right? again, long answer to your short question, because these good questions of yours have very detailed answers that there's a lot behind it.
Well, I appreciate your insights. You know, geez, it's already 40 minutes has gone by in a flash here. Do you have any last minute thoughts here, Senator, before we head off? I really appreciate your time.
Nope. Like I said, happy to do it as often as you want to. It gets busy this time of year. I would just say that the last thing that's probably hot right now is the budget and trying to get as much capital as we can, because we're way behind in deferred maintenance and building new things, roads, et cetera, especially in the MATSU, we're growing. So that's the hot topic now, is going to be the capital budget and the operating budget. PFD, I predict, will be pretty small again. And we're going to, you know, add how much extra, a couple hundred million to the budget. So that's the battle right now that we'll be in for the end of the session. And then this is a big election year, so I don't anticipate us staying past the last day. We'll take it down to the wire as we usually do, because that's a pretty good MO they use to put pressure on people, make them cave. That's, they know that works. But I don't anticipate any special sessions or any other wacky stuff, because again, it's campaign year. Everybody's going to want to get out of here and get what's most important and near and dear to a politician's heart, regardless of what they say, is getting reelected and keeping the seat, because that's really what many of them absolutely care about, is staying in that seat of power. So I think we'll get out of here on time being 4 months, not the 90 days, right? The 120 days. And we'll pass a budget that we really can't afford, that prioritizes government over private sector, that takes away more of the dividend. And that's the path we're on. So that's what I predict. Not great news, but we'll muddle through. And assuming oil prices stay high and the stock market performs and we see how the election goes in November, that will give us a really good path, honestly, Jonathan, for not just state government, but for federal government, right? Depending on who gets reelected in November. And the reason I say Trump versus Biden is Trump, I hope, will immediately undo all of Biden's executive orders and let us start drilling and mining and doing the things we need in Alaska to survive, that Biden has essentially shut us down to almost zero. And that will be a boom for us, right? To help us start booming and building, which we need to do. And, you know, that will mean we'll probably spend more money as a state government. But anyways, that's not the best result. But we do need to be moving. So there's hope on the horizon. We'll see how November goes. I think that's going to be the big telltale for Alaska over the next 4 years, and see how we're doing.
Awesome. Well, Senator, I really appreciate you joining us. We wish you nothing but success here for Must Read Alaska. We'll get you back on soon. For folks that listen, watch, and read Must Read Alaska, if you want to help keep the lights on, just go to mustreadalaska.com. On the right-hand side, there's a little donate button. Every $5, $10, $100 helps keep the lights on here at Must Read Alaska. Want to sponsor the show? Just email me, John, J-O-H-N, at mustreadalaska.com. We'd love to have you sponsor the show. Senator, we hope you have a good day and a good rest of your week. And for everybody else listening out there, we hope you have a phenomenal rest of your week. Until next time, I'm John Quick from somewhere in Alaska. Thanks.